Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're a generous sort, and you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or a one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If this isn't your thing, you can always purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks at our Teespring store if you feel inclined. Check it out. Today, my guest is Tracy Sylvester. Tracy is a native of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. She got her education at the University of Vermont in fisheries biology and management. She's been a commercial fisher in Alaska for over a decade and currently runs the salmon troller FV Faithful out of Port Alexander and Sitka, Alaska. She's been a Fishery Conservation Network Coordinator and Community Outreach Specialist with the Alaskan Commercial Fisheries, as well as Social Scientist and Fisheries Biologist with NOAA throughout her career. She's participated in almost every aspect of fisheries and fisheries management, including community-supported fisheries, through her company, Wooden Island Wild, which brings wild-harvested Alaskan seafood to the East Coast of the United States. She was recently a co-author on a paper, Alternative Seafood Networks During the COVID-19 Pandemic, Implications for Resilience and Sustainability, which appeared recently in Frontiers in Sustainable Food Systems. Welcome to the podcast, Tracy. I'm super excited to chat with you. I really can't stress enough how important it is to talk to folks in all facets of fisheries and seafood production. So I'm really grateful that you took the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I'm super interested in your extremely varied background. That's so cool that you've got to participate in all these different areas. Your background literally stretches from coast to coast in the United States, from Massachusetts all the way to the waters off of the west coast of Alaska. Do you have one memory that really sticks in your mind about sort of your first introduction or your first real love of the ocean?
Well, that has to have been when I was a baby. Both of my parents are from South Boston, Massachusetts. So my mom used to walk me around in the stroller around the Sugar Bowl out in Southie. So I'd say that has to be the first time that I had the salt air in my hair and was feeling, you know, nautical and excited about the ocean. And my mom unfortunately passed away when I was little. I was almost three when she died, which has definitely played a big role in the moving around a lot and just kind of being up for going anywhere. My dad's always encouraged me to go. And I know that it's probably been helpful to feel like I kind of always have her by my side when I'm on the ocean. I'm always kind of living for her, I guess, in some ways. Then we moved down to Cape Cod when I was in middle school. So I grew up in Sandwich, Massachusetts, where there's lots of salt marshes and you have great access to the rest of the Cape. When I was, you know, like in middle school, I'd be riding my bike around from our house. And luckily there was tons of awesome marshes to explore right there. I feel like my love for the ocean and fishery science definitely came from playing around in estuaries and salt marshes. And I love spending time on the water. We never had a boat, like an ocean going boat when I was growing up. So I got a kayak when I was 16 and I'd get out on that.
Yeah. In the marshes there?
Yeah. I was all over the salt marshes and I love getting out, even if you're just on a paddleboard or a kayak, it feels so good to even get, you know, 2 meters from shore. It's like,
oh,
total perspective.
Definitely.
And it just feels good just being like floating on the water. And it feels so good to be able to see into the water more easily than you can from shore. So I was out there all the time. And I was working in restaurants ever since I was maybe too young to be working. And so the Cape gets so busy in the summer with tourists and restaurants are packed. So, you know, after my shift, before my shift, I was just always on the water, just kind of decompressing.
And yeah, for sure. I was actually going to ask you about living on the Cape because it's such a tourist area, right? It's such a major tourist destination. I spent a little bit of time in Woods Hole and the weekends and the summers were always just crazy.
It gets pretty bad. And that's another reason why getting on the water is so nice, because it's very touristy, but there are all these little pockets that you can find like Woods Hole, there's this beautiful little marsh right in the middle of town here. And there's these little trails that go through it. And it's been so nice to be, I moved back here right before the pandemic hit. When it was quarantine lockdown, we just had this little patch of marsh down here that I could go down to with the kids. And it was just wonderful. It was just like, I love Cape Cod, that there's all these obnoxious mansions and tourists come swarming in the summer, but there's still these pockets that have been preserved. There's really a lot of life in there. It's really incredible. And it's amazing how well the animals use it too. You know, mm-hmm. like there's a whole pack of coyotes and deer and every night here in Woods Hole, almost every night we hear the coyotes.
I feel pretty similar about where I live. I live in St. Petersburg, Florida. And when we moved here, we moved from Charleston, South Carolina, which also has an expansive marsh, tons and tons of marsh. And I love the marsh. And we moved here, you know, and the marsh is replaced by mangroves. And it's kind of city and it's kind of touristy. And it took me a while to sort of find those pockets like you're talking about, but I found them. And now they're kind of the only places that I ever go in town is into my little estuary and tree kind of pockets.
Yeah. Coming back from Alaska a year and a half ago, it was a rough transition again. It was kind of like, oh boy, like all these cars and, you know, the beaches, especially in the summer, like the popular beaches it's really frustrating that you can't just ride down to your local beach and park in July.
Yeah. We have the same thing not as much in the summer, more at spring break. Our spring break lasts for 6 weeks and it's everyone from the whole country comes to our beaches when our weather is good.
Yeah, it's been, we've been here. We were here last summer too, because of COVID. We decided not to fly up to Alaska with the kids and everything. So it was my first summer back on Cape Cod since a long time. It's been so incredible with the seal population coming back and the sharks have been coming back on the outer coast. And I can't say that I'm happy about it, even though I think sharks are cool. I'm sad that I can't, you know, teach my kids to boogie board at the same beaches I used to, because there's like six great whites swimming around on any given day. The six tagged ones that they're aware of, you know. But it's such a cool, I love how much science goes on back here on the Cape too. It's really a cool place. So I think I was probably a little more influenced by all of that than I even remember. You know, like I know I did really cool field trips down to Woods Hole and the New England Aquarium, and Province Sound Center for Coastal Studies does all kinds of cool work here too. There's more, you know, Audubon is big here. There's tons of birds. So yeah, lately I'm kind of still into fish, but starting to get a little excited about birds too.
So your first trip to Alaska was in an internship from college?
Yeah, so I had an internship with the U.S. Forest Service, and it was to restore watershed integrity and salmon habitat. We were blasting old logging bridges and culverts in the Tongass National Forest, which is basically all of Southeast Alaska, Alaska's panhandle off the coast of British Columbia. And it was interesting. It was unpaid internship, but I was like, okay, I'll go to Alaska and blow shit up. That sounds awesome. A lot of the logging had happened about 100 years ago. Some of it was more recent. So there were these giant ancient old growth trees that they had fallen over the rivers to make the bridges. Mm. So sometimes there was cement poured over the top of them, but they were usually pretty rustic. It was usually just, and it'd been so long that a lot of the gravel or whatever they'd finished the top with had worn away. So it was like a lot of crawling around in rivers, more like creeks and little streams, and fixing the explosives up around these old fallen trees to blast them in such a way that the log would hopefully fall back down into the river and create some habitat. So it was really fun. The largest blast of the summer was 7,000 pounds of explosives and four bridges, kind of along Fish Bay in Southeast Alaska. And Fish Bay is on Baranof Island, just north of Sitka. I got to blast that one. That was really
got to press the button.
Yeah, you can do a button or you can punch a code in like a walkie-talkie, or you can then there's like this box thing too you can use. I forget what that's called.
I have this kind of like Wile E. Coyote idea, you know, of like the hammer you put down.
Yeah, you can do that. And it's like maybe not the best way because it's, you know, the button is, it's literally just like a button. The code thing is kind of the preferred way maybe, but the button is kind of fun to, we set up the button for that one because it was so big. It was really fun. I got to stomp on it. And then it was just like this tremendous, it was just so funny, like stomping your foot and having such a tremendous. And we did culverts too. There were some culverts that were kind of jammed up. So I'd be like crawling through culverts, pulling out debris, pulling explosives through to blast. And it's all this stuff called Emulex. It's not explosive until you put the detonating cord on it and together. So there's kind of like these large chains of sausages, kind of like pre-made cookie dough packages all strung together that I'd be like dragging around in the creek with waders. And so it was a lot of physical work, and it was so fun to be out in the forest, and there were all kinds of cool birds. And I didn't see that many fish because we're so far up there, and the time of year we were doing it because we're trying to be minimally affecting anything that would be hatching in the creek. A lot of the rivers were not salmon streams, or creeks were not salmon streams because they had been blocked out of there, or, you know, so the idea was that we were hoping to just give them more options, give the fish more options to come up. We did a little bit of building fish ladders too, and quite a bit of hiking around all the watershed, just checking to see if there are any things that could be improved for fish habitat. So it was just a lot of hiking and waders. It was cool. There's a lot of grizzly bears. There's Baranof Island is part of the ABC Islands, the Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof. Those three islands have the densest population of grizzly bears on the planet. So there's a lot of bears. There's like 2 bears per square mile on average, but of course you'll find them more around the creeks.
So, yeah, sure.
That was the time of year they were awake, but not necessarily super hungry yet. Mm-hmm. They sort of started to get a little more hungry towards the end of the summer, and we were seeing them a lot more. So we had a couple of close calls with the bears. And so that job also involved a whole rifle training, you know, bear protection component. The first 2 weeks of training at the Forest Service in Sitka were all safety and bear training. So that was pretty fun. That was actually a really good way to spend your first 2 weeks in Alaska. It's just training.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot that can happen.
Definitely. Yeah. Especially when you're pretty far from any kind of significant medical attention or anything like that. So from there you started working in commercial fisheries as a tender.
Like I fell in love with Southeast Alaska, and some of the people at the Forest Service had told me like, don't talk to the fishermen when we're in town, you know, they hate the Forest Service, and they were very serious about it. But I was like, well, I'm a fisheries student and I think I'm going to talk to the fishermen. So I did, and ended up meeting a few people that just encouraged me to come back. And I talked with the Forest Service a little bit about coming back, but after my unpaid internship, the jobs were, you know, they just didn't pay enough for somebody who's got student, who's trying to pay their way through school with student loans. So fishing was appealing. The unpaid internship thing needs to die.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of people on that train. You know, I think it's really in a lot of industries, you know, the only people who can afford to get into these lines of work are people who are supported in some other way. And is that really what we want?
Yeah. And I had done it with just always working as a waitress or a bartender when I wasn't in school, or it like cleared out my savings. And yeah, the second year I was debating whether I should go up. I wanted to make sure I had a job that I could come home for my senior year with some savings. And 3 of my friends from Vermont joined me, and we signed up to be kayak guides in Juneau, naturalist guides. And when we got up there, they had said they'd have housing for us, but we got up there and there wasn't housing. It was like a 2-bedroom apartment. There were already 10 boys who were literally in a frat together. There's sort of the summertime tourist scene in Alaska that they just bring in tons of these, you know, college age workers, and didn't work out for us. So we went back to Sitka because I was like, oh, I know some people in Sitka and I think we could probably find a fishing job because I've talked to some people, like, let's just go. So that's why we ended up back in Sitka walking the docks looking for a fishing job. I don't think I would have flown all the way up just to hang it out there like that. But I basically needed a job and was kind of couch surfing. So we wrote on the chalkboard at the Pioneer Bar in Sitka that we were looking for a fishing job, and particularly a tendering job, because a lot of people had recommended that as a good entry position for somebody wanting to get into fishing.
So can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so tendering is basically just a larger fishing boat. It doesn't have to be any necessarily particular type. Like, we were on a smaller tender, which is a longliner most of the year. So a small, like, family-run longliner, whereas there's other tenders that are like the crabbers from the Bering Sea come down and tender. So they're huge. So a tender can be, you know, different sizes, but it needs to be big enough that you can offload other smaller fishermen. So the one we were on had a 100,000-pound hold. So that's big enough to be kind of a smaller cleanup tender. So we would kind of scoot around and get little loads of fish that the bigger tenders had missed.
So you weren't actually setting gear for the fish. You were picking up fish from the people who were catching them from the water?
Yeah. So the first year tendering, we were just, you do a lot of running with tendering, like a lot of driving around. That's the fun part about it, is you get to see tons of water. You get to do a lot of navigating, and you basically, when a fisherman is full, they'll call into the plant and say, is there a tender around? Or, you know, usually the tender announces themselves when they come into an area. So you offload fish, you give them ice. Sometimes you give them things that they need. Sometimes, you know, like cookies or
ice cream.
sometimes you'll give somebody like a ride that needs one, or... Mm-hmm.
So it's moving back and forth between the people who are catching, is it primarily salmon?
Yeah, it was all salmon. We were doing that year, we were tendering for gillnetters and salmon. Sitka's over on the outer coast. So Sitka's actually the only town in Alaska that faces out to the open ocean that way. Mm-hmm. And the Tlingit name for Sitka is Sheetka, which means the outside of Ka, the island of Ka. So we were over on the inside, kind of near Juneau and Petersburg, going between Juneau and Petersburg and Haines on the inside passage. So there's cruise ships coming and going. There's more icebergs over in there. I've never seen an iceberg on the outside. There's glaciers right there. Yeah, so we were mostly doing gillnetters all summer.
They're collecting fish from the water in their gillnet. You are taking it to the processing plant on land?
Yes. It was really interesting, as, you know, a fishery student, to see the variation in quality between boats. And, you know, I know how long they've been out. I know where they've been. And sometimes it doesn't make sense that this one boat is bringing in beautiful fish and the other one's bringing in crappy fish. And so I learned really quickly how much it matters that you have a skillful skipper who really knows, you know, how to put the net in and out and how to pick the fish in a way that maintains quality. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting too, just from the foodie, like, restaurant perspective as well, seeing how much variation there can be just when it's coming onto the tender, which is the first landing. In this case, the fishermen can of course go into town and offload directly at the plant, but tendering is meant to, like, increase efficiency, help the fishermen make more money, reduce, you know, fuel costs and use and everything. Jesse, my partner, he grew up fishing in Southeast Alaska. He grew up in remote town of Port Alexander. He's a really good fisherman, and seeing the difference in quality of the fish when he delivers, is, people always remark on it. And one of the things he does is he slushes the fish as he's cleaning them, like right after he pulls a gill to bleed them, he'll throw them in a slush tank to let them bleed out and stay nice and cold in there. And it really, he just started doing that a couple years ago, and we really noticed it's just beautiful product. So there's just these little tweaks that you wouldn't think necessarily would matter a whole lot, but they really do. It's been really fun to learn how to fish with a partner too, who's, like, patient. And and I did fish before I met him. I fished with another friend of mine and did some long lining with Jesse and his dad. But yeah, he's done it his whole life. So it's really, like, there's really a lot of skill to learn there, you know, like, you can spend a lifetime learning how to be a better fisherman, I think. But people who grew up doing it, it's really kind of second nature. And I think that, now I'm saying that, like, that is something that I think gets a little lost with the messaging. Like, you know, just in the media right now, like a movie came out, Last Man Fishing. A lot of our friends are in that movie. And you, a lot of times you hear about fishing talked about like, well, you know, we want to save it for our children and our grandchildren. And sometimes I think the general public is like, well, who cares if your son's a fisherman? Like, if I'm a musician, what if my kid can't be a musician because he needs to make money? Like, so what, you know? Or, but it's like, I think it's lost that there's a lot of skill in handling the fish properly and really being a good steward of the resource that you can't just teach in college necessarily, or you can't just learn it in a couple years. Really, quality handling is something that is like really artisanal and handed down through generations. And the best example of that would be, you know, the stewardship that the indigenous people of that area in particular, the Tlingit in Southeast Alaska, have shown in the way that they've maintained these amazing ocean resources for tens of thousands of years and not taking more than they need and not wasting anything. There's a lot of like intricate details that are part of the skill of handling, harvesting and handling the fish that I guess could really use some more definition or exploration of how much that really matters to producing the quality product, you know?
Now, with fresh flash freezing technologies and all of this, I mean, people want to be able to get pristine fillets all the way across the country, and they can, and it's amazing.
It's so great to be getting like really nice product into the can instead of like fish that's like almost going to go bad. So it's canned or frozen. It's fish that's canned or frozen as soon as it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your current fishing company. You and Jesse own Wooden Island Wild.
Yeah. So we launched we've been dreaming up Wooden Island Wild for a long time, over a decade. Wooden Island is a really remote island off the tip of Baranof Island in Southeast Alaska. You know, we love fishing, but it's like, it can be so boom and bust. And especially if you're trying to fish in a way that's really small, you know, small boat, attention to detail, attention to quality, trying to, you know, stay low impact and treat every fish with the respect that it deserves. It can be really hard financially to make that work because you just don't have the volume every year to really do it. And if the price you're getting paid for your fish drops, it can really tank you. So a lot of people who are trollers, like in our fishery, you know, trolling is fishing, hook and line. And we have a configuration. So we have two sink lines and two float lines behind the boat. And we have hydraulic girdies to pull them in and out. And then off of each line, we have these monofilament snap-on fishing lines. On those, there's usually some kind of lure, like a little spinning spoon, and then just a hook. We don't use bait. So basically, we are trying to look like a glittering school of fish behind the boat. Mm-hmm. And so salmon, you know, a lot of times the salmon will kind of follow us for a while. We'll have a few following. And then, you know, you go over like a certain swell that sort of shakes the spoons in such a way, and all of a sudden, they all bite. You know, so you're kind of just fishing like in a much more traditional way. You know, we get very little bycatch. Anything you catch you didn't want, you can generally release it.
How many hooks are you running at the same time?
Depends like how deep you think the fish are, because you can use the hydraulic girdies to move the gear up and down. There's cannonballs on the end of each line to draw it out and pull it down. About 30 hooks.
Okay.
Sometimes less, sometimes like 12. Sometimes a lot more. We target usually coho salmon. Sometimes a year we target king salmon. We're allowed a really short window to catch king salmon. That's really tightly regulated. And then there's pink and chum fisheries that we don't really get involved in, but those ones you use a lot more hooks because there's just a lot more schooled up. That fishery, you're fishing closer to like a river, delicate dance on the outside coast too. We're trying to catch some ocean bright ones. With the trolling, you're getting a different product because you're catching the salmon before it's right at the river mouth. It's more like you're just picking off a few as they go by.
Yeah, I don't know anything about sort of the regulation within those fisheries. Is the season very short or is it more prolonged? Is there size limits or?
With king salmon, they have to be over a certain size and you're only allowed to catch them basically for trollers in our region, it's July 1st is usually the king opener, and Fish and Game monitors that really closely. They're literally counting each king as it comes in.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to do this because trolling is so basically small scale, but it's still a lot of fish coming in. So the fish come down the slide at the plant, and I've did this job before. Actually, one summer I worked for Fish and Game as the salmon port sampler in Sitka. And that was another great example, in addition to the tendering job, where I got to see the variation in different boats coming in. And like some people come in and their fish is beautiful and they've been out for 5 days and it all looks great. Other people come in, they've been out for 2 days and it all looks like rags, like totally. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like, that's where kind of the direct marketing motivation comes from with a lot of fishermen, is they don't want their beautiful, well cared for fish getting mixed in with some person's fish that doesn't take care of the product. And, you know, we worry about all of us getting paid a lower price because our beautiful fish gets mixed in with this fish that wasn't handled professionally. Trollers get a power troll permit that you buy, and it allows you to participate in these fisheries. You can participate in different salmon troll fisheries, and king salmon is one of them. And that's generally has been like the most valuable because they're worth so much per pound,
mm-hmm.
which is another reason why it's motivating to direct market. Because if you can get a good price per pound for, you know, pink salmon, then who cares if it's a king or, you know, as far as like running your fishing business, it's, you know, the fishermen get frustrated that they're, you know, we don't want to put any extra pressure on a resource that we see could be possibly dwindling, or, you know, so I think the one of the reasons why you see a lot of fishermen trying to direct market is because they see these inefficiencies firsthand and they want to address them in a way that is meaningful. The king salmon is relatively very short season, just like can be just a few days or just a week or two. And then in August, if all the quota wasn't caught, they'll have another little king salmon opener. Total allowable catch is monitored by Fish and Game, and they, you know, they look at all their data and they get back to the fleet after a couple weeks and let us know if we're allowed to catch anymore. In the meantime, we're always fishing coho. That season opens up. Basically, that season is like June to September. Cohos, you know, they get bigger as the season goes on. So things really start to pick up in July, August, and September. The cohos can be really big and they're a little bit closer into shore. Trollers will go all over Southeast Alaska, but we tend to fish just around Port Alexander and Sitka and up in Chatham Strait. We like being kind of like close enough that we can come into shore, especially when we're fishing with the kids.
Sure.
And we ice fish, and some of our friends freezer troll, so they have blast freezing systems on their boat. But if you ice properly and you do it skillfully, it is also a really great way to do it. So there's kind of a role for both.
And so how long are you usually fishing for?
We usually sell every 3 days or so. 5 days is kind of the max. You don't really want to have fish caught 5 days ago on ice. Five is kind of fine. And then if you sell to a tender, it's still going to maybe take a day or two to get to town. So with that in mind, we usually sell to tenders down there because there's no fish plant in Port Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
So we usually offload every 2 to 3 days, anytime they're there, basically. So that's another example of like just this work ethic that Jesse has had growing up, is like, not all fishermen do that. There's kind of these little things that fishermen who are really focused on quality and just stewardship and just also just sort of the relationship to the fish. Like it feels like you should do right by the fish as well. You know, they say it's like a gentleman's fishery. I don't know what else we could call that.
A family fishery.
Yeah, it's the perfect family fishery because it's like the boats are small. They're like romantic wood boat.
Oh, I love the smell of a wood boat. I know people don't, but it is like the best smell.
It's so cool. And it's such a nice ride. It's
a wood boat that's the hull's been around for ages and it's just like smells like diesel. Oh, it's home.
Yeah, our boat was built in 1989 and it's really cool. It's like, that was definitely part of what drew me into that fleet in particular, was just like these beautiful boats. Like they were so cool. And coming from New England, I was like, I didn't even realize that working waterfront of this caliber still existed. There's like 500 small boats like that. Sitka's powerhouse fishing port, but it's this also really low-key island town in a lot of ways. And there's just really cool people, all kinds of cool culture, just music and art. And so it's, there's so much that goes along with it besides just the fishing that drew me in. And there's a lot of fishermen who have advanced degrees in science too, and this, especially in this fleet. So that's interesting too. And then with trolling, it can be such a slow thing where sometimes you're trolling around all day and you don't catch anything. So
yeah,
with, you know, seining and gill netting, you're a little bit more on a schedule, on a mission. But with trolling, you'll be out there. Sometimes it's like, and you're like, we'll go fishing basically all summer, but we'll be in and out dropping off fish. So we live on the boat all summer.
Is your whole family working together, or you two working, and you have small children, right?
Yeah. So I took last year I didn't fish because of COVID. And the year before that, I took off because I was working for the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association in Sitka. My son was only two, so that's basically the worst age to do anything.
Often, yes.
My daughter's always been very cautious. Like, just even since she was a baby, she'll look really carefully before she walks down like the slightest ramp or something, you know, and just like charges around. And I was worried to take him. And basically I haven't gone in 2 years, but we're going up this summer. We've been also just trying to balance where we live, because Alaska's like the support for humans in Alaska is really lacking, like the healthcare and schools.
So your company, Wooden Island Wild, is considered a community supported fishery?
Yeah. So, and within the community supported fishery world, you know, there's just been a thread even the past couple of days talking about like, where does this begin and end? Or, you know, like, can anybody claim to be a CSF? Or so there's definitely a lot of talk about, you know, how do we actually define that term? And, you know, the main thing is that not just the community is supporting the fishery or me as a fisherman, but also like I'm in turn taking my role in the community very seriously on both ends. This is just kind of what it means to me, is that like I'm spending time back here in Woods Hole and Cape Cod, and there's a lot of work here to do as far as public education or just outreach within the science community on connecting directly with fishermen and some of the initiatives fishermen are taking that people here might not be aware of. The Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association in Sitka just got this, I think it's a grant to develop hybrid engines for the fishing boats. You know, here in New England, a lot of the fish policy is being made back here, you know, or like the fishery scientists are being, you know, working or being trained here. And so I've noticed a real disconnect between the different fishing regions in the U.S. Like it's a way that things are here. And then things in Alaska are very different, where the community is more, at least in Southeast Alaska and in Sitka, it's, you know, a lot of times the scientists are the fishermen and the fishermen are the scientists and the artists and the baristas, you know, so it's like, I've always balanced fishing out with some science work. Then we've always had people back here asking how to get good fish. And we just didn't really have a way to do it. It's too expensive and a big pain to try to process your own catch and freeze it, ship it, store it, and then start selling it before you ever make any money. What happened last year is that we belong to a fisherman-owned cooperative, the Seafood Producers Cooperative, and it's actually the oldest and largest fishermen's and most successful fishermen's cooperative in North America. They're based up in the Pacific Northwest. And so when we came back here, I was kind of half thinking I would get back into some work down here in Woods Hole, but also we would hopefully be able to continue fishing. Our co-op offered to help us get product back here. So they're able to send us product that we can market here. So it's some stuff that was caught by us or some stuff that was caught by other members of our fleet. What's been great at the co-op lately is they've been really cracking down more on quality issues, and they're seeing so many fishermen move to direct marketing because they haven't cleaned up the act on those kinds of things that now they're starting to. So seeing more companies direct marketing has kind of raised the bar for our co-op. That's all happened really quickly in the past couple of years. The board has a lot more progressive fishermen on it now who are just really excited to get the message of these family-owned boats out there. Because before, we have all this cool story behind it, but the consumer would never know because
Absolutely.
So usually our fish was getting sent to like restaurants or sometimes restaurants around the world, but we had maybe more of ours was staying a little more domestic, but still there's this whole problem of fish being sent overseas to be processed and then shipped around the world. Fishermen don't want to hear that. And like when you're looking each fish in the eye as you pull it on board, it's like with hook and line fishing, you really don't want any morsel to go to waste. You know, like it, there's definitely, you feel like responsible for stewarding the resource as much as you can. We finally were able to start direct marketing with the help of our co-op, which has been really interesting to me. Cause like I said, we were thinking we wanted to do it all alone, but now that the co-op is pulling it together and I'm seeing the quality on this end, like I'm really happy with the quality. I'm like, oh, okay. Like we don't have to make a big deal about it being from our boat. It's actually a much stronger, more interesting story that we belong to a fleet and we belong to a fisherman owned cooperative that is giving us this flexibility. And it's great if a fisherman here or a fisherman there can get better money for their catch by selling directly to consumer. But if every fisherman did that, it wouldn't work, you know, and not every fisherman can do that or wants to do that.
Sure. Absolutely. And you definitely need some groups of people who are able to do that. So you were also involved in a research paper that recently came out with several other authors looking at the effects of the pandemic on supply chains and small scale businesses like yours. And so we've heard a lot over the past year about sort of supply chain disruptions and how global distribution issues have been a real problem. And every once in a while, you know, the general public will hear about how that's been for fish processors and fish distributors and stuff like that. But in the paper, you and your co-authors found that small businesses like yours and like your co-op really have done pretty well. I think that's really great. I find it to be super encouraging.
Yeah, I think it's one way. And I mean, I think a lot of us in all different sectors have, you know, these stories of how the pandemic kind of peeled back some inefficiencies or opened up new opportunities. It's like for me personally, so for my work on that paper, I was doing a lot of the like, you know, informing the like social scientists on how we were being affected. And, you know, for us, we were so new, we just started direct marketing in February when the pandemic hit. So it was like, okay, this isn't going to work. But then, you know, luckily I've got the skills that I could set up a website. And this is where I mean, like, not every fisherman can do this. So I just feel a lot of responsibility to continue to be inclusive with the way that I'm marketing. And I really want to use this platform for public education on just all the cool stories behind the fish and not just limit it to what's going on my boat. But yeah, the co-op is really what, so I'm just so thankful that we have that, you know, because besides the co-op, they're just fish buyers that are, you know, they're just these giant multinational corporations. A lot of them have recently been bought out by even larger corporations that own big aquaculture programs around the world. So we need that independence as food producers, you know, just like other food producers, we need to be able to have that. And it just comes back to even just being able to tell your own story.
Well, and I think that that was one of the things that the article pointed out too, really, was that it showed just the resilience of this kind of small scale production and something that's really going to be necessary moving forward as we move into, you know, more frequent disruptions from a lot of different sources, thinking more and more about what we can do on smaller scales that don't rely on these massive multinationals.
And so actually I found a shop here that I can open a retail space.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm really excited because it's going to be like a community building place where we can kind of bring fishermen and scientists and tourists together. And it's right where you hop on the ferry to go to Martha's Vineyard. So And, you know, Falmouth is like Catherine Lee Bates is from here, America the Beautiful. And, you know, it's a very like American Main Street scene. And like, I just love the aesthetic of the building. I think it's really going to help tie kind of the art and the science and the, you know, the just the lived experiences of fishermen or other people that work on the water You know,
it's like a coffee shop with salmon.
Yeah, basically. And it's right across from a hub, like a coffee shop that I've been going to for 15 years. It's going to be focused on all direct from producer products. So our fish is the backbone, but I want to carry all kinds of things that complement the fish and are also direct from the producer. And I mean, that's kind of the main thing that, with the paper that we're getting at, is like, when the supply chain is so complicated and there's so many people making money off of the producer and the consumer, and it really does get lost, that when something like this happens, it can totally collapse, because there's not, community is not whole. Or when I was here and COVID hit, I started doing just one farmer's market up in Boston, the SOA. Yeah, like just seeing how excited the customers were to be able to come outside and get what they need and not have to go into like giant supermarket. And there was a lot of other vendors like me who were like, it felt good to have that place to connect. And it pretty quickly got me thinking about how it would be nice to have some kind of physical brick and mortar space to do this work. And our stuff is, you know, comes from far away. So we're a little bit of a farmer's market misfit, because we're not a local product. And there's other people at farmer's markets. Like, there's a friend of mine who sells coffee that his family grows and roasts in Colombia. It's the best coffee I've ever had. He sometimes can't get into a market because the product's not local, or he doesn't like roast it locally. But he lives here and he's bringing a great product that you can't get anywhere else, direct from the farmers, his family. So I see that as exactly what I want to support. Also help kind of draw these two working waterfronts that I love together. There's definitely a lot that we can learn from each other. I think that's the other thing I should mention, is that our shop is going to continue to be just frozen or shelf stable, because it's really important to us that we promote that for seafood consumption, because, you know, frozen product from Alaska is really what you should be asking for. I mean, fresh has to fly on a plane to you. And when it's frozen and flash frozen and vacuum packed up at the source, we can let it add up and then ship it slowly in bulk this way. So it really keeps the impact, the carbon footprint down, and it really reduces waste. With everything changing so quickly right now too, it's like sustainability is just always a moving target. I've definitely noticed like people, you know, they're like, oh, like they want to, their food to be as like eco-friendly as possible, which is great. But it's also, there's a lot of other ways that we can reduce like plastic use or our carbon footprint. Like we're working on, like I said, the hybrid engines. And then we're doing all kinds of cool collaborative research with scientists in our fleet up in Alaska. Mapping the seafloor and doing, we didn't talk about long lining much, but that's the other fishery that I'm involved in for halibut and black cod. And there's a project there, a sperm whale avoidance project. And that's what I was working with the Longline Fishermen's Association on.
Tracy, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to me. And now the tough part of the interview is over and it's time for my final questions. We always start off really simple with, what is your favorite fish?
I would have to say salmon, but I don't know if I could narrow it down. I think I almost want to say pink salmon. I mean, king salmon are just so beautiful and, you know, like sexy is my professor. The pink salmon are just so incredible. They're just so resilient. You'll find them up in all kinds of little creeks, and they can sometimes go up and spawn multiple times and go back out, like more than any other species of salmon. Pinks will possibly go spawn back and forth like multiple times. The king salmon, I just love. They're just so beautiful, like big, beautiful fish. And fish are cool. And I don't know. I don't think I can. I also love like sea lampreys, just because they're so weird. There's just this incredible stories about the herring woman and the Tlingit stories about herring being part of their lives. It's just so, such a beautiful tradition worth protecting, and totally fascinating. And the herring just being the base of the food chain, I mean, you gotta love that.
What is your dream job or location?
I guess I'm lucky to say that I have my dream job. I'm fishing seasonally in Alaska, and then I get to escape the dark rainy winter and come back to one of my favorite places, Woods Hole, where there's all kinds of awesome science going on in the community, all kinds of cool talks to go to and people to meet at the coffee shop. And now I'm able to bring that quality catch from Alaska here to share it. And it's also giving me a platform. My fish from Alaska is giving me this platform to also connect with fishermen here. And so we're going to be able to have, you know, like flash frozen fish that was caught right here. And to just kind of prove that point that it doesn't have to be fresh in a cage. Be able to be a connector and a networker is a great feeling.
And my final question is always, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
The first thing I think of is know your fishermen. Just from, or I guess just keeping in mind that like human beings are, you know, part of the natural world. And I think of fishermen, sustainable fishermen who are really, you know, hands-on. Not just get to know your fishermen, but try to get to know like all the people that produce your food and understand more about why it's sustainable or why organic is good. And I think that can lead you down a rabbit hole of understanding more about, you know, how water moves across the land and why it's important that we maintain soil integrity, riparian zones and wetlands and forests that clean our water and produce our wild foods. There's a lot of debate right now between, you know, wild food from the ocean and aquaculture. And I think there's a balance to be struck there, and think about the way that the water is flowing through our groundwater, is flowing under our feet, and we're part of this big living machine. You know, as I'm walking around the marshes in Woods Hole, like I'm standing on the, you know, like anaerobic part of that machine, like the first few tanks being like dark, basically just microbes starting to treat the waste. We really need to preserve the forests. And that's like a big part of what drives us as fishermen in Southeast Alaska, is we're able to have this whole fishing economy based on this wilderness, the Tongass National Forest. And it's so important that we keep the trees in the forest and don't cut them down, soil and everything. And, you know, you see a lot of know your fisherman or know your farmer, but it's not just like knowing their name at the farmer's market. It's people have very intentionally work. They're working in food to try to affect change and try to basically save the world.
Absolutely.
Fishermen and farmers and food producers, like they, you know, whether it's like beekeeping or fishing, I think it's really important to get to know these people. And also, as far as fighting climate change and going into this uncertain future, I don't think anybody can claim to really have a plan on how we're going to do that. But I think we need to, the first step is just looking around at each other and appreciating each other and strengthening our community bonds so that we, you know who to call for input on things, and just to get to know your neighbors and to try to understand and like live with compassion. And
thanks so much for coming on the show, Tracy. If our listeners wanted to get in touch with you or even order Sioux food from Wooden Island Wild, where could they do that?
Well, so we are opening a new retail shop in Falmouth, Massachusetts, in a couple weeks, and we ship throughout the Northeast. Our website is woodenislandwild.com, and we are at a few farmers markets in the area, and our fisherman-owned co-op, the Seafood Producers Cooperative, they ship nationwide. Or if they just want to get in touch, you can email me, tracy@woodenislandwild.com.
And all of that will be in the show notes. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at @fishvecchio. You can find the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @fisheriespod, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget that you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution on Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts and hoodies available on Teespring. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this 120th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, get to know your fishers and support your community.